The question of a trial for Saddam Hussein also came up in London today. Speaking before Parliament, British Prime Minister Tony Blair said this is a matter for the Iraqi government and the Iraqi people.
I think it's for them to determine what penalties there may be arising out of that. And I think it is important that we recognise that it is only in circumstances where a country is incapable of actually mounting a proper tribunal that we have recourse to international tribunals.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair speaking earlier today before Parliament. While we do not yet know where or when Saddam Hussein may face trial, what the specific charges would be or who would bring them, history is regrettably replete with precedent. We'll talk for the remainder of this hour about what we can learn from trials that did take place and those that didn't, and about some trials currently underway. Is the purpose of a war crimes tribunal justice or politics? Can trials of defeated leaders help their nations come to terms with their crimes, or are they scapegoats? To what degree is the purpose to discredit leaders' policies or their political party? Are there times when possible war criminals should be allowed to make a bargain to, for example, negotiate a bloodless transfer of power? If you've lived in a country that's gone through this process, we want to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Gary Bass. He's the author of Stay the Hand of Vengeance, The Politics of War Crimes Tribunals. He's a politics professor at Princeton, and he's spending this year as a visiting fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School. He joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good to be here.
We have about 3 minutes before the break. Before we get on to the lessons of history, let's talk quickly about Iraq. What type of plan do you see developing?
It's likeliest, as the president and as Tony Blair have said, that this is going to be an Iraqi court. There's actually some provision written into the statute that was set up a week ago to include international judges. So there's at least a possibility of making it a more international effort. But as Tony Blair said, it's going to mostly rest with Iraq.
Well, he also said that international tribunals are mostly for circumstances in which the countries themselves are incapable of holding the trial on their own. And a lot of people would say he just defined Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the obvious accusations that's going to be made. I also think that there will be accusations made that by saying that you're just leaving it up to the Iraqis, there'll be a lot of accusations within Iraq and within the region. And certainly, I think from Saddam, once he actually starts mounting his own defense, that the Iraqi Governing Council are just American stooges and will try and delegitimize the trial as being just crude victor's justice.
Is there a possibility that there could be an element of international, some international lawyers, some international judges as well as Iraqis?
Yeah, I mean, it was the Americans who insisted on writing that into the statute at the last minute just to give the flexibility. Whether or not the Bush administration or whether or not other members of the international community would want to go that far, we don't know at this stage, but the option's on the table.
And what about the focusing on crimes against Iraqis, as we mentioned earlier, the Iranians, the Kuwaitis, conceivably the Israelis, though that might be a little hard to imagine politically. Certainly the Americans could all bring charges against Saddam Hussein as well.
Yeah, the tribunal statute does right up front in Article 1 actually mention that Iran and Kuwait will be included in it, or the crimes committed against Iranians and against Kuwaitis will be included in it, but there's no specific provision for having Iranians and Kuwaitis participate. You can imagine how bringing, in particular, Iran into it would be very problematic. And like you said, the scuds that were fired at Israel, which were hitting civilians, that would also be a war crime, but politically that would be obviously very difficult to bring in.
If one of the difficulties, and we just have a few seconds left, and we do want to get on to the lessons of history, but if you had to make a guess, I mean, this is going to take months to arrange all of this, and there may be a new government in Iraq by that time.
Yeah, and I think there'll be a real worry about how long the trial goes on. The Milosevic trial is now running it over 2 years, and I think that the Iraqi Governing Council would be very reluctant to see it take that long.
Well, we're going to now talk about the examples of history. When we come back from a break, we want to take your phone calls as well. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We'll be speaking about justice and reconciliation. What can we learn from the experience in other countries about how the trial of Saddam Hussein might affect Iraq? I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Thank you. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing war crimes and war crimes trials as evidence is assembled against Saddam Hussein. What can we learn from war crimes trials of the Rwandan massacre or the war in Bosnia? Does the process of truth and reconciliation help or hurt a wounded nation? If you've had experience with efforts for national reconciliation, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Gary Bass, the author of Stay the Hand of Vengeance, The Politics of War Crimes Tribunals. And Gary Bass, in general, what's the purpose of war crimes tribunals? Is it justice or is it politics?
Oh, it depends on who you ask. I mean, I think to lawyers, then the point is to deliver individual criminal accountability to somebody who is a common criminal rather than a head of state. But there is this whole much broader range of political objectives that these things inevitably accomplish, that they can be, as some people argue, an effort to promote reconciliation, to bring out truth, a kind of, you know, turning the courtroom into a grand classroom to explain exactly what was done under Saddam or under Milosevic or under the Nazis. There's also, it can blunt victims' desires for vengeance. There's a whole long array. It can strengthen the international rule of law.
And it can also serve to discredit the policies or the political party of the people who are on trial.
Absolutely.
Let's get some listeners involved again. 800-989-8255. And our first caller is Reza, or Reza. I hope I'm not mispronouncing it too badly. She's on the line with us from Boise, Idaho.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, he is on the line. And excuse me.
Excuse me again. It's Reza. You're right. That you said it perfectly, actually. I have a quick question for you. Where do you draw the line as far as... I'm from Iran originally, and I, saw with the Shah of Iran, where, granted they were an ally of the U.S., that's why he didn't get the tribunal or any kind of court after the revolution. Where do you draw the line, or Milosevic, for example? Now they're talking about handing him over to, having a trial in Iraq with the Iraqi courts, and obviously the justice on that will be a lot more harsher than if he was to be even hanged by, the United Nations or the, military tribunal in Hague.
Mm-hmm.
How does the United Nations sit down and decide who gets what?
Yeah, who gets to decide, in other words?
Right. Which is it going to be depending on how, I believe there isn't a government in this world who hasn't done as much as Saddam has, really.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much they, depending if you're on the winning side or the losing side.
Gary Bass?
Yeah, I think, at its crudest, then that's correct, that the reason why... Idi Amin never faced trial was that he was hiding out in Saudi Arabia and that nobody was physically in a position to get their hands on him and put him on trial. And Saddam was just as much of a war criminal 2 days ago, but now somebody's actually in a position to do something about it. And that means you get into very, very complicated debates on how you make that raw exercise of power look legitimate, right? That you want to, on the one hand, you want to have the power so that you can actually get these guys, but you don't want it to look crude and thuggish and unfair.
And there are all kinds of problems in arranging them. For example, have they yet figured out what to do with the crimes of Pol Pot and his henchmen in Cambodia?
No, Cambodia and Mozambique are sort of talked about as the two hardest cases where it seems to be almost impossible to figure out mechanisms that would provide for justice. Part of the reason is that the responsibility is so widespread that you have, and in Cambodia you have, a leader, Hun Sen, who's very reluctant to allow these trials to go forward. Lurking in the background, it's not like China is terribly enthusiastic about having a full accounting for the Khmer Rouge period, and also probably not the United States.
Reza, thanks very much for the question. It's a good one.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. And Gary Bass, a lot of us think war crimes trials begin at the end of World War II, Nuremberg and Tokyo trial, and there was also the trial in the Philippines. But they, in fact, go back earlier than that.
Yeah, that's right. There were trials held in the aftermath of World War I, both for Germans up to and including the level of Kaiser Wilhelm II, the German emperor, and also in the Ottoman Empire, where the British had in custody some of the most senior members of the Ottoman imperial government, who were accused of crimes against humanity for the genocide of the Armenians, as well as for war crimes. And these trials, I think, tend not to be remembered because, unlike Nuremberg, which is seen as sort of the jewel in the crown, the trials after World War I were disasters. The defendants either got off with a slap on the wrist in the case of Germany, or were freed altogether in a hostage swap, which is what happened in Turkey. And it had the worst of all worlds. The victims, whether they were Armenians or Belgians, felt dissatisfied, felt that justice had not been done. On the other hand, Germans and Turks felt that they were the victims of high-handed victor's justice. So there was sort of resentment created on both sides and no real justice done.
You cite Nuremberg as the gold standard, I guess, of international war crimes trials, and I'm not prepared to argue with you, but looking back on it, sitting there on the High Court judging German war criminals was representatives of a country of Joseph Stalin, who was, some would argue, just as much of a war criminal as Adolf Hitler.
Absolutely. I think that there's a tendency within the human rights movement, and I understand why this is done, to hold up Nuremberg as sort of such a shining example. But there's a tendency, I think, to somewhat forget the incredibly dark role that the Soviets played. Stalin actually originally said that what he wanted to see done to German war criminals was to execute between 50 and 100,000 of them. Then when he was pressured by the Americans into actually holding trials at Nuremberg, then his idea of what Nuremberg should be was a Soviet-style show trial, that the indictment was a statement of facts rather than an accusation to be proven in court. That I think it is, and in this sense, actually, I think it's remarkable the extent to which we now have liberal governments that are doing these things, that you don't have that kind of Soviet thuggishness, overt thuggishness. You know, what the Soviets did was about as bad as victor's justice can get.
Let's get another caller in. This is Rob, who's on the line in Oakland, California.
Yeah, hi. I'm just concerned about the transparency of war crimes trials. I mean, if a closed trial can even be considered legitimate, especially vis-a-vis the one coming up ostensibly in Iraq. I mean, I think that the last thing the Bush administration wants certainly is Saddam Hussein sitting in the dock talking about how much support Iraq got from the U.S. throughout the 80s. You know, I mean, they were taken off the list of terrorists in 82 and diplomatic relations and supported with arms and intelligence throughout the Iran-Iraq war. So the big concern I have is that this process remain open to the press and transparent. If it doesn't, and it isn't, and it's somehow managed without that transparency, I don't think it'll have any legitimacy.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the experience that we've had with Slobodan Milosevic in The Hague, where he gets up and makes, I think, roughly the same sorts of points that Saddam is likely to make in his own defense, it cuts two ways. That on the one hand, it's very frustrating, right, that you know, having bombed this guy, we now give him the opportunity to stand up in court and have his day, which has actually gone on for over 2 years. On the other hand, it does show that he is allowed to conduct his own defense. And if he does it in a ridiculous way, then that's his decision and his responsibility. There have been secret witnesses that have been called in some of the trials.
For example?
Well, we don't know. They're secret.
In the Slobodan Milosevic trial.
In the Milosevic trial.
I see.
And in other trials that the Yugoslavia Tribunal in The Hague. And there have been a lot of accusations from Serbs and Croats that this is unfair, that this looks a little bit Stalinish, that we don't really know who the witnesses are, so how can anybody mount an effective defense against that?
And are there examples of closed trials where sensitive subjects that might have touched the toes of some of the powers bringing the charges were not raised?
There's some of that. I mean, that you know, when you have a British prosecutor at Nuremberg, then it means that prosecutor can choose not to bring up things that the British government doesn't want to talk about, that the Brits decided that they weren't going to include charges about aerial bombardment precisely because Britain had done a lot of aerial bombardment and they didn't want to be subject to accusations that you're doing the same thing. But overall, I mean, that's the reason why an open trial is such a difficult thing, that we're going to give, having defeated Saddam Hussein in a war, the United States government is about to give him a microphone to talk to the Arab world And in many cases, I think that there'll be some receptivity to some of the things that Saddam is going to say about American imperialism. He will complain about how America has unfair standards in human rights that aren't applied impartially, and some of that is definitely going to resonate.
I remember some of the charges against Karl Dönitz, the naval commander in Nazi Germany, were his conduct of unrestricted submarine warfare, and Chester Nimitz, the U.S. Admiral in the Pacific, ordered the conduct of unrestricted submarine warfare, I think, on December 8th, 1941. So that's another example of some things that don't necessarily come up. Anyway, the most famous defendant in international war crimes trial right now, as mentioned, is the former president of Yugoslavia, Slobodan Milosevic. Today he was back in court at the International Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia at The Hague when Democratic presidential hopeful Wesley Clark testified against him behind closed doors. Milosevic faces war crimes for atrocities allegedly committed in the Balkans during the 1990s. And joining us right now is Ian Black, a European editor of The Guardian newspaper. He's with us, and good to have you back on the program.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me.
Where does the Milosevic trial stand right now?
Well, we're finally coming towards the end of what's been a very long period of the prosecution case. We had General Wesley Clark today, as you've just said, behind closed doors. In the final weeks, the final days even of the prosecution case, there's going to be a break in the new year. And then in the spring, probably about April, we will hear the beginning of Milosevic's defense. If you've been watching the trial, you might have thought it had already started, but that isn't the case. What he's done is to cross-examine witnesses who so far have been called for the prosecution.
And how long would the defense, any idea of how long it might take?
Well, you know, it's anybody's guess. It's a very, very long and laborious process. Milosevic himself, who trained as a lawyer and, of course, has been defending himself from the beginning, is very long-winded. It's very repetitive. Virtually every time he's in court, we have exchanges between him and the judge, the British judge, Richard May, asking him to keep it short. And there are concerns, real concerns, about his health. The trial has had to be suspended several times now when he's been feeling unwell. And I think there is a real fear on the part of the UN prosecutors that ill health may eventually intervene again to curtail what is still a very, very important trial.
Why was the reason, of course, Wesley Clark was the NATO commander during the Kosovo War. What was the reason he testified behind closed doors?
Well, the simple answer is I don't know, but there is a provision in the tribunal's rules to allow governments who are concerned about national security issues to request that witnesses who are or were government officials be given this kind of protection. The assumption is that in the case of General Clark, who was the commander of NATO, there may be questions to do with intelligence sources and methods. We know clearly that NATO was listening into Yugoslav communications during the Kosovo crisis, and it may well be to protect that sort of information from being exposed publicly.
We're speaking with Ian Black of The Guardian about the trial of Slobodan Milosevic, which is currently underway in The Hague. And we're also speaking with Gary Bass, who's the author of Stay the Hand of Vengeance, The Politics of War Crimes Tribunals, as we look ahead to a possible war crimes trial of Saddam Hussein. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Ian Black, in general, how has the trial of Milosevic affected people in Serbia? Have they helped that place come to terms with some of the things that Milosevic did and some of the things in which many Serbs participated?
Yeah, I think that as a general point, it's clear from the experience of the Yugoslav tribunal that holding war crimes trials is a good way of helping resolve the pain, the conflict that is left behind when a war has ended. Milosevic is charged with terrible crimes, as are other people who are still at or have been up before the Hague Tribunal. And there is quite a clear sense that bringing people to justice for their crimes so that there is no impunity for terrible crimes is part of the healing process for societies that have undergone the trauma of war. And it's quite clear that people want this to happen. Only today, with the reaction across the world to the capture of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, we heard Muslims in Bosnia demanding that more be done to bring to justice Radovan Karadžić, the Bosnian Serb leader, who is facing, like Milosevic, genocide charges at the Hague Tribunal, but is still a wanted man, has never been found. People want it to happen. There is a genuine call out there in these post-conflict countries for justice to be done.
Ian Black, thanks very much. Ian Black is European editor of The Guardian newspaper, and he was on the line with us from his home in Brussels. He's among the reporters who's been covering the trial of Slobodan Milosevic. And still with us is Gary Baths of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, or at least that's where he is this year. He's normally at Princeton University. And I wanted to ask you about the comment that Ian Black was saying about reconciliation and the thirst of people to see these criminals brought to trial.
Yeah, I think it's an extraordinary thing, actually, the willingness that Bosnians have to say that what we want to see is Ratko Mladic or Radovan Karadžić, who were the respectively the military and political leaders of the Bosnian Serbs, that we just want to see them brought to justice. That what you would tend to think is that people would say, look, hundreds of thousands of us died and there's no such thing as justice. How could we ever be satisfied? We have an enduring resentment against the West and against America for sitting by for 3.5 years while we were getting massacred. I think it's actually an extraordinary thing that victims will be prepared to be to some degree satisfied with the process of international justice. I also think that there's a huge danger if you do not deliver that process, that you tempt people towards vigilantism, that you tempt lasting and enduring bitterness.
But how far down the ranks do you go? In addition to leaders like Milosevic, there are a lot of what are sometimes deemed trigger pullers who may not be responsible for the policies overall, yet acted out on the orders of their superiors.
Yeah, I mean, I think here you're limited by both by politics and by logistics. Politically, the further down the ladder you go, the more you get into, you know, if you are charging Serbs who were firing shells during the siege of Sarajevo, then there are an awful lot of Serbs who would feel implicated in that kind of action, and that can create enormous nationalist backlash among Serbs who will really feel quite threatened. So if you aim at higher ups, it's easier to say, oh, Mladic, or oh, Karadžić, or oh, Goring or Milosevic. These are people who the average Serb or German doesn't relate to as much. There's also just logistically that the sheer number of perpetrators will overwhelm almost any judicial system. Saddam Hussein did not act alone. It's estimated that there were as many as 500,000 trigger pullers, hands-on killers in the Holocaust. And there's no way that any judicial system could possibly bring to justice every single murderer.
We'll have more with Gary Baths after we come back from a short break. We'd like to hear from you as well. As you look through history at examples of war crimes trials that went ahead, were they helpful? Did they succeed? What about the examples of situations where war crimes trials did not proceed? Situations, for example, in Chile or Argentina or Cambodia. Give us a telephone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. As I said, we'll be back after a short break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're discussing war crimes tribunals and how they help heal or hurt their nations. Our guest is Gary Baths. He's a visiting professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and the author of Stay the Hand of Vengeance, The Politics of War Crimes Tribunals. And let's get a caller involved. If you'd like to join our conversation, by the way, the number is 800-989-8255, or you can send us email at totn@npr.org. And let's go to Danny, who's with us from Waltham, Massachusetts.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I wanted to comment on the on the part of Pinochet in war crimes back in Chile in the 70s. Are you with me?
Yes, I am. This is a retired general and former Chilean president, Augusto Pinochet.
Correct. And Pinochet was arrested, as you probably know, in 1998 in London. And what the arrest did for the Chilean people, it helped them, first of all, to put Pinochet as part of the past, not the present anymore. So I think that the Iraqi people can achieve the same with the events in the last days.
Just to clarify, he was arrested in London on charges that were filed in Spain.
Correct.
Regarding war crimes in Chile.
Correct.
And eventually a British court said, if I remember correctly, it didn't have jurisdiction and sent him back to Chile.
Correct, correct. They did not eventually trial him, but him being absent from the country for 16 months or more basically allowed the Chilean people to adjust and to understand that they can, A, live without him, put him in the past, and also it opened the door to trial many others that were involved in war crimes, and those trials are going on today. So I think that, again, for the Iraqi people, it's an opportunity to trial not only Saddam, but only also other people that are involved and were involved in many war crimes against his own people and other nations in the area.
Gary Bass, let's bring you into this conversation. And obviously the situation in Chile was one of those circumstances under which a leader sort of negotiated a bargain to arrange a transfer of power in his country in exchange, saying, and I won't be tried for anything.
Yeah, he actually gave himself a self-amnesty that he declared that he could not be prosecuted. Now, of course, he didn't have any jurisdiction over Spain or over London, so these other courts, got into it, and that was a way of sort of dodging around the amnesty. But the underlying point is that in many cases, including Chile and South Africa and lots of other cases in the sort of wave in the 1990s of democratizations, in many of these cases, the outgoing regime is strong enough that it can secure an amnesty for itself on its way down. Saddam didn't have that opportunity. Milosevic did not have that opportunity. Milosevic fell in a revolution, so then people could do whatever they wanted. Saddam is now in the custody of the United States, and people can do whatever we want. That the backbone of those regimes in Serbia and in Iraq are broken in a way that Pinochet's never was. So Pinochet could buy himself a measure of security that Saddam and Milosevic can't.
If I may add another important point that I think it's very important for the Iraqi people to move forward now. The Chilean people understood after Pinochet was arrested that the only way that they can progress in the reconciliation process of the country was by trying the people that were involved in war crimes. And I think that the Iraqi people, in order to have an internal reconciliation and allow people to move on and have a healthy society, they have to put on trial people from their own nation that were involved in war crimes. Not only Saddam, but all the people that were under his regime operating and basically following his orders, his murder orders. So I think that is important for them in order to achieve a reconciliation within themselves, not with the international community, but within themselves.
Danny, thank you very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Joining us now from his office in New York City is Philip Gurevich, a staff writer with The New Yorker magazine. He covered Rwanda for the magazine and wrote a book about the genocide of an estimated 800,000 Tutsis in 1994, an oral history called We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, Stories from Rwanda. Philip Gurevich joins us now from New York City to talk about the UN International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, which has handed down thus far 17 sentences since late 1994. And welcome to the program.
Hello.
Do Rwandans pay attention to these trials?
They do to some extent, but then the fact that the United Nations set up its tribunal outside the country and did so with a very poor press office and without any coherent outreach program makes it very difficult for Rwandans, as a rule, to keep track of these trials in any kind of day-to-day procedural fashion. They tend to be informed of the verdict. Those are things that get played on national radio or so, and the overall judgment. But the important part of these trials for the societies that have suffered the abuses that are being tried is obviously the actual day-to-day procedure, the presentation of evidence, and also the whole example of the conduct of an examination and the conduct of due process justice. And that is not something to which Rwandans have much exposure through the tribunal. If anything, the tribunal's distance keeps them at a distance.
One aspect of that series of trials has been the prosecution not just of murderers and political leaders, but recently three members of the media were convicted for their part.
Well, I mean, they're called members of the media in the sense that they are people who use the media to be murderers and political leaders. But they're not, in any sense, members of the media like you or I or journalists or reporters or even publishers in any kind of normal free society. These are people who were essentially state propagandists who used things that looked like newspapers and a radio station to direct the killing and to stir up the passions and instruct people in the ideology of and the practice, the very specific nitty-gritty practice of mass murder.
When you were in Rwanda, was there a sense amongst the people you spoke with there that, war crimes trials could bring justice?
I think there's no question that there was the feeling that trials could bring justice. The question was always one of where and how they should be conducted. And there was the real tension that took place in Rwanda and has sort of lasted ever since, now almost 10 years. In 1994, after the genocide, the physical plant of justice in Rwanda, literally the courtrooms and lawyers' offices and prosecutors' offices, were thoroughly trashed by pillage and looting. And most of the lawyers in the country had either been killed or, by virtue of either being killers or sympathizers with the killers, had fled or the country. And so you really had no infrastructure whatsoever for justice. You had investigators who literally did not have bicycles or pencils. And in this absence, in part, and also because most of the major figures in the administration of the genocide had fled the country, the UN set up this tribunal outside the country. But there's a problem there, which is in the meantime, Rwanda put 100, 150,000 people at one point into jails in Rwanda on charges of genocide. These were people who had not fled, who were there domestically. And there's a little bit of a problem when you have an international tribunal trying the same crimes that are being tried domestically, that the international tribunal almost implicitly suggests that the native system is incapable of rendering quality justice.
And yet, in a way, you're saying it is.
Well, the question is, where does one want to put one's resources? And I say that with an eye towards Iraq now, obviously, because if one were simply to say, look, the Iraqis aren't capable of doing this right, and take it completely away from them, I think we would all recognize that that would seem somewhat problematic, and these days the world would be called imperial. On the other hand, to let them do it entirely by themselves obviously might not work, and it seems to me that the effort should be the resources that are put into international tribunals, what if they were put somewhat towards using international assistance, legal assistance, expertise, and everything else to help build the institutions that are missing, to help build the capacity that's missing, to help familiarize and instruct a society that is trying to make a transition or that we are hoping to see make a transition towards making that transition.
Philip Gurevich, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Philip Gurevich, staff writer with The New Yorker magazine, the author of We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, Stories from Rwanda. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. And Raymond joins us from Rock Stream, New York.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thanks.
It's not a question. I have a comment. I'm a vet of World War II, and this is something that's concerned me ever since the Nuremberg trials. We set a precedent there. In every war, both sides commit horrible atrocities. I mean, there's no one questioning that. But the way it's set up now is the winner tries the losers. If by chance we lose the next war, you can be darn sure Mr. Bush would be on trial by the people who won it. Or, for example, if Japan had beaten us, Harry Truman would have been tried. And this is a precedent that concerns me because in every war, both sides have commit horrible atrocities. I mean, the British, the bombing of Hamburg and so on, I mean, that was a horrible crime. But as was mentioned earlier, this was deliberately left out of the Nuremberg trials. I mean, the mention of the bombings, because they didn't want that to be brought up. And the fact that Stalin, who, as again was commented earlier, killed millions, he was one of the worst people that ever existed, he was one of the people trying the losers. And I don't know how we get around this, but the fact is, it's just a fact of life now that the winner is going to try the loser.
Gary Bass, comes under the general rubric of the phrase of victor's justice, and it's a fundamental fact of power, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, there's an element of victor's justice, even to the reason why, a cop arrests a criminal. There's there's power behind that. But I think that it's a mistake to assume that all victor's justice is the same thing, that victor's justice can mean that it is, obviously it's the stronger power that's trying the weaker one. But that doesn't mean that there couldn't actually be some measure of justice inherent in it. That I think if Nazi Germany had won World War II, then we would have got nothing like Nuremberg. We would have got a Nazi-style show trial, but there wouldn't have been, as there were at the real Nuremberg, acquittals, the use of evidence, all of the things that are the hallmarks of a fair trial domestically. Those would be left out. I also think that there's been some progress in since Nuremberg. That Nuremberg was, as Raymond correctly pointed out, it was a court of the victors. It was Britain, America, the Soviet Union, plus France. We were sort of pretending that France hadn't lost in 1940. But the UN court for ex-Yugoslavia and the UN court for Rwanda, which Philip was talking about, these include judges from all sorts of countries who are not directly responsible for the military victories that made these courts possible.
There's a further question that goes on from what Raymond had to say. And Raymond, by the way, thanks very much for the call. And that's the question of collective guilt. And it certainly came up in the case of Germany, and it comes up again in the case of Rwanda. There are an awful lot of people who either participated in these crimes or looked the other way. How do war crimes trials deal with this? Or is the process, and we just have a couple of minutes left, it's late in the conversation to bring it in, of truth and reconciliation, as they had in South Africa, is that an appropriate venue to answer those kinds of issues?
Yeah, you can see truth commissions in either as being an alternative to war crimes trials or as being a supplement. If they're an alternative, then it's something more like in South Africa, where there just weren't initially prosecutions. Using them as a complement means saying that there are, there are limits to how many people we can actually manage to put on trial, and we don't want to put everybody, every single member of the Nazi Party on trial, because that would just be too overwhelming. But there will be some sort of quasi-judicial accounting that will broaden the scope of what's happened, and can talk about things that were clearly evil but aren't actually illegal, like people who are sort of passive collaborators or who just went along with what was happening in Nazi Germany or in South Africa, but weren't actual hands-on trigger pullers.
Mm-hmm. In that sense, would it give them an opportunity to expiate their guilt?
Sometimes, although I think it's sort of an open question as to whether or not these public expiations, whether they help or hurt, that there's sort of a therapeutic paradigm that it's good to just get it all out in the open. And I'm not sure that that's always the case. I mean, you wouldn't want, I don't think that would be one's approach to, say, a rape trial, that what we really need is to sort of air all the details. And also, I think when that airing of all the details is coupled with impunity, as it was in many of the people in front of the South African Truth Commission, that they were, because they testified, it meant that they couldn't get prosecuted, that therefore some of the victims would feel this guy is getting off scot-free.
All questions and thoughts to bear in mind as we consider the prospect of a war crimes trial, not just for Saddam Hussein, but for many others in Iraq. Gary Bass, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Neil.
Gary Bass wrote Stay the Hand of Vengeance, The Politics of War Crimes Tribunals. He's currently a visiting fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.